To begin the study about, we're going to take a look at some different things about the Da Vinci Code, and I'd just like to read the first page of the Da Vinci Code to you. It says, "The Priory of Sion, a European secret society founded in 1099, is a real organization. In 1975, Paris's Bibliothèque Nationale discovered parchments known as the secret dossier." Dossiers, which I'll say it in English versus French, identifying numerous members of the Priory of Sion, including Sir Isaac Newton, Botticelli, Victor Hugo, and Leonardo da Vinci. Second point, the Vatican Prelature, known as Opus Dei, is a deeply devout Catholic sect that has been the topic of recent controversy due to reports of brainwashing, coercion, in a dangerous practice known as corporal mortification. Opus Dei has just completed construction of a $47 million world headquarters at 243 Lexington Avenue in New York City. All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate." Now, if you read started reading the Da Vinci Code, this book right here, and you read that first page, would you have the impression from that first page that what's going to be in the book has some truth? It's historically accurate. Sounds like it, doesn't it? It gives you that impression. And what piqued my interest in the Da Vinci Code, I read an article about the book and the claims that it made about Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene. And someone asked me about reading that book, and I told them I didn't think so, and because I knew what the claims were, and that's just nonsense. But then I, after looking at it more carefully and thinking about it, I thought, well, it would be interesting to look at this and what's said, because people do believe what's said in the book. And so well, what we're going to do is we're going to look at some of the points that are made here and see if they're actually valid. Are they historically accurate? And the scary part is, as you look at some of these things, people really do believe these things. That's the scary part. Now, you might say, why address this subject? How does it pertain to us as the Church of God? Well, here's why. The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown has been a tremendous publishing success. In the middle of 2004, the book had been on the New York Times bestseller list for 63 weeks. It's a lot of books. Early in 2004, it was selling 100,000 copies per week in hardcover. And what's the price on that? It's $24.95. So that's a lot of money that's being spent on that book. Now, I'm sure people get it cheaper, but still people pay a hefty sum for hardback books. When the paperback comes out, which I think it is out now, they're going to sell millions of other copies because the cheap people hold out for the paperback. The really cheap go to the free public library and check it out, like me. Why am I going to buy a novel if I don't have to? The book itself is fictional, but as one reads it, it becomes apparent that Dan Brown's characters are actually making historical claims about Jesus, about Mary Magdalene, and the Gospels. In other words, the fiction is built on what appears to be a historical foundation that the reader is to accept as factual, not fictitious. It comes across that way as being factual, but the question is it factual? And why be concerned about that? Who cares? It's just a novel. Just a novel. How many of you have heard of a novel that was written quite some time ago called The Divine Comedy? Has anybody heard of The Divine Comedy? By a man named Dante. And one of the things in The Divine Comedy was this picture of hell. And for a lot of people, they read The Divine Comedy, and that's the picture of hell that's in a lot of people's minds. The picture that Dante put down as fiction, but that's seen as accurate. And what happens is people can read a work of fiction and it can influence how they think about things because they don't know the true facts about various issues. For instance, You look at the Da Vinci Code as it was hitting stride. A movie came out entitled The Passion of the Christ. It made its debut, and it was very successful as a movie. And a lot of people went to see that movie. And what's the problem with that? Well, their whole image of the last hours of Jesus Christ are going to be influenced by that movie. Because they're not going to go read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're going to look at the movie. It's easier. But it does not give you an absolutely factual presentation of the last hours of Jesus Christ. I don't remember any women, if you've seen the movie, going in and mopping up blood. I don't remember that. And I don't remember anybody handing Christ a towel and he wipes his face on it and you happen to see this image that, wow, the Shroud of Turin. I don't remember that either. Okay? So that's all. But see, what people can see these images and they don't bother to check it out more carefully, and that begins to influence popular opinion. So the authors and filmmakers can impact public thinking, and that's something that is a reality. But when the images they create for their readers or viewers are erroneous, it means people misunderstand history as it really was and substitute fiction for facts. That's the problem with it. So our goal, first and foremost, is to have an answer for questions that come up about cultural subjects such as this. Now, when I was at camp this year, there was a question about this particular book, The Da Vinci Code. So everybody said, well, does anybody know anything about that? And I was the only guy that raised my hand. So you're going to answer that question. Okay. Because I had, been thought about it, and so I intended to do a Bible study on it, so I was able to answer the question. Well, here's a brief synopsis of this to lay the groundwork for this, the Da Vinci Code, just so you know what it's about. The Da Vinci Code begins with a mysterious murder in Paris of the renowned curator of the Louvre, Jacques Sarnier. Because of bizarre religious symbols left at the scene of the crime, drawn by Sarnier himself, just before his death, a master of religious symbology, Robert Langdon, a professor at Harvard who is in Paris to deliver a lecture, is called in to investigate. He's joined by a police cryptographer, Sophie Neveu, who happens to be Sarnier's granddaughter. She and her grandfather have been estranged for 10 years. What Langdon and Neveu don't realize at first, but eventually come to learn, is that Sarnier was the head of a secret religious group known throughout history as the Priory of Sion, which has always guarded the secret to the true nature and whereabouts of the Holy Grail. Now, what is the Holy Grail? Does anybody know what the Holy Grail is? The cup that supposedly they caught Christ's blood in. Is that right? Isn't that right? It was from the Last Supper. But I think it has something to do with his blood, too. But anyway, you've had this quest for the Holy Grail. You have the knights out and everything like that. But it's the cup of Christ, okay? If you saw the Last Crusade, Harrison Ford, Temple, going to find that cup, that was the big deal, and so they're looking for the special cup. So that's been a thing that's been in literature for quite some time. So anyway, a bizarre set of circumstances sets Langdon and Neveu on a search following the clues that Sarnier has left behind, with the ultimate goal of finding the mysterious and long-sought grail. Also in the pursuit, however, are those responsible for Sarnier's death, who evidently killed him while attempting to learn the whereabouts of the grail. These mysterious others have used members of the fanatical Catholic order Opus Dei as pawns to lead them to the place of the grail's hiding. In the course of their adventures, Langdon and Neveu meet up with Sir Lee Teabing, a wealthy aristocrat and expert on the grail, who discusses the historical background to its mystery. The grail is not the cup of Christ, but the container that held his seed. It's in fact a person, Mary Magdalene, who was Jesus' wife and lover, who became pregnant by him and bore him a daughter. After his crucifixion, Mary and her child fled to France. And there, the divine ancestral line of Christ was continued down through the ages. There were secret documents kept about the existence of this bloodline of Christ. These documents celebrated the feminine principle in early Christianity and include a number of early gospels that came to be suppressed by Christianity in the 4th century, specifically by the Emperor Constantine. Constantine destroyed the 80-some gospels that were vying for a position in the New Testament, elevated Jesus from being a mere mortal to being the Son of God, and completely silenced the tradition about Mary and the divine feminine, demonizing the feminine in Christianity and destroying its true nature as a celebration of the feminine deity. But the Priory of Sion has for centuries known the truth about Jesus and Mary and has long met in secret in order to celebrate their holy union and to worship the divine feminine. The secret society, of which Jacques Sarnier was the most recent head, has kept the tomb of Mary Magdalene and the hundreds of documents that told the truth of the divine feminine. Other famous people have headed the Priory of Sion and celebrated the truth about the marriage of Jesus and Mary, including, notably, Leonardo da Vinci, who painted Mary Magdalene in his famous fresco, The Last Supper, and give hints of the truth of Jesus and Mary in many of his other works of art, there for those with knowledge of the truth to see and revel in. Langdon and Nauvoo, with the help of Lee Teabing, gradually unravel the mystery surrounding the Grail, and the secret documents reveal its true power as they follow an intricate maze of cryptograms that lead from one place and puzzle to another, until they arrive at the truth of the Grail and the place of its final hiding. So that gives you an overall idea of what the novel's about. So what we're going to look at today are historical foundations of the book. How much of what is found in the historical background of this book is fact, and how much of it is fiction? How much truth is there in the Da Vinci Code? And we're going to begin by looking at one of the bad guys in the book, that is Constantine, the Emperor Constantine. And as you look at the book and why it has a certain appeal to it is because it talks about good and evil. And stories with good and evil are always appealing to us. Good guys, bad guys, cowboys, Indians. Maybe not the best analogy, but used to be cowboys and the Indians. Or we're looking at Darth Vader and the dark side versus Luke Skywalker and the good guys. You know, those are the kinds of stories that we like, and we can all relate to them. And that's why this story has an appeal. The lead characters, Robert Langdon and Sophie Nauvoo, are the good people, and the bad characters are Lee Teabing and his chauffeur and an albino monk named Silas. In fact, the fact that this man had an albino monk in there outraged all the albinos, so they were all up in arms over that. So there's always somebody to be offended. Also, the historical figures on which the story is based can be aligned with good and evil. Of course, Jesus and Mary are good figures from the past. On the other hand, the Emperor Constantine is portrayed as a really bad guy. He, in fact, is said to be at fault for many of the ills that came to plague the Christian religion from his day onward. According to the characters in the book, Constantine was the one who altered the form of Christianity for all time. Is that true? Emphasizing, don't be too quick to say yes, but we'll see. He did alter it in certain ways, but not like you may think. He altered the way the book portrays him as altering Christianity is emphasizing the masculine, making it a patriarchal setup, and demonizing the feminine, falsely attributing deity to the mortal prophet Jesus. See, the book says that Jesus was a mortal prophet, and it was Constantine who, at the Council of Nicaea, got them to vote, and they voted that he was a deity, that he was God. Is that accurate? Also, he suppressed earlier Gospels that celebrated Jesus' humanity while canonizing, making the official text those that perceived him as divine. So this is what's laid out there, and is this true? So let's start with the question, is it true that Constantine remained a pagan for his entire life and never actually converted to Christianity? Is that true? All right. Now you have to realize, as I read several books on this, none of them are written by what we would they would be termed nominal Christians. And so they don't have the same perspective we do. So you have to realize they would probably say he was a Christian. But we're going to look at the facts and see if he was. And you will have to judge for yourself. And it's not going to be hard to make a judgment, right? But you need to know the facts. So we're going to begin with a conversation between two characters, one of the positive characters, Sophie, and the bad guy, the arch bad guy, Lee Teabing. And they say, and it begins this way, "I thought Constantine was a Christian," Sophie said. "Hardly," Teabing scoffed. "He was a lifelong pagan who was baptized on his deathbed too weak to protest." 3 centuries after the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, Christ's followers had multiplied exponentially. Christians and pagans began warring, and the conflict grew to such proportions that it threatened to rend Rome in two. Is that accurate? Constantine decided something had to be done. In 325 AD, he decided to unify Rome under a single religion, Christianity. Why would a pagan emperor choose Christianity as the official religion? Sophie asked. Teabing chuckled. Constantine was a very good businessman. He could see that Christianity was on the rise, and he simply backed the winning horse. Okay? So, in some of the things that are said here, there's some truth, and there's also some fiction. And so we want to think about Constantine here a little bit. Now, we mentioned that there was all this warring going on between pagans and Christians. In the 300s AD, was that accurate? Well, the facts are that Christians prior to Constantine in the early 4th century, that is the 300s, were a small minority within the empire and were subject to persecution by the overwhelming majority of groups, by the pagans and by their governmental authorities. So they're giving you this idea that Christians are a pretty large sized group and they're battling the pagans for control. And the facts are, as you go back and look at history, that that wasn't the case. The Christians, in fact, were a fairly small group, and they were being persecuted. I know there were the numbers were much larger than the church today, but they were being persecuted. The term pagan refers to any of the adherents of the empire's polytheistic religions. Polytheistic means more than one god. And since everyone in the empire, with the exception of the Jews and Christians, worshipped many gods, this included the vast bulk of the population. So we're familiar with the Greek and Roman mythology. We know the Greek gods Zeus and Ares and Athena. And we know the Roman gods Jupiter, Mars, and Minerva. Those are gods of those two populations. But more than that, there were gods of every locality and every function. Gods who specially dwelt in and protected cities and towns throughout the empire. For instance, the goddess of Athens was Athena. Okay, so you had different goddesses that protected and watched over various towns and localities throughout the empire. Gods of family and household. Remember, there's the god Juno. Gods of forest, streams, and fields. Gods of various functions. They made the crops grow. They made the livestock fertile. They protected women in childbirth. They provided health and wealth. And they were gods who could do small favors for an individual who asked. Kind of like the genie in the bottle type of an idea. During this period of the Roman Empire, there was a movement toward one god as superior to others, as the god overall. For instance, does anybody remember who Constantine worshipped before becoming a Christian? Sol Invictus, the invincible sun. He worshipped the sun god. And he looked at that one god as the god overall. Now, so he had taken this religious position before becoming a Christian. Now, once Constantine converted to Christianity, he appears to have thought that this god, Sol Invictus, was really the Christian god. They're one and the same. And so the pagan religions of the empire worshiped many gods in ways that seemed appropriate to them. It's important to realize that this to make sense of what took place between pagans and Christians. Now, when it's said that pagans and Christians were warring against one another, that's not exactly the case. There were violent struggles, but historically, they were almost entirely one-sided. What was happening was the pagan majority was warring against the Christians with the hope of wiping them out. That was the goal. And as we well know, Christianity had been a persecuted religion from the beginning. Its founder, Jesus Christ, had been executed, hadn't he? It wasn't long after his death that Stephen was executed. James was killed. And the Christians were persecuted by Paul. Paul led that persecution. But as time went on, persecutions were increasingly undertaken by the Roman pagans and their administrative officials. And the reasons pagans hated Christians had to do with the pagan understanding of the gods. The gods, they, from their perspective, from a pagan perspective, provided good things in life, health, prosperity, love, peace, and so on. And they offered these things in exchange for worship. So as long as you worship me, things are going to be good. So if you sacrificed animals, you offered foodstuffs, and you said prayers to them in their honor, then they were happy. And the gods weren't jealous of one another, insisting that worshipers adhere to the religious rites pertaining to only one or to the other of them. So these, their perspective of gods is, you know, if you're a worshiper of Zeus and you're in Rome, it's perfectly okay to worship the Roman god while you're there. And they weren't going to be jealous about you doing that. That was their perspective. All of them were gods and all of them deserved to be worshipped. But what happened when they weren't properly acknowledged? So if people didn't acknowledge these gods, what happened? Well, they could get angry. And when that happened, watch out. The gods might retaliate with any manner of natural disasters, plague, famine, drought, earthquake. And when these things occurred, the simplest explanation was that it was the gods who had brought these things on. And they were unhappy. And the reason that they were unhappy was they hadn't been paid proper attention. But who was it who refused to worship the gods in the ways required? The Christians. The Christians were the ones who insisted that there was only one God, the God of the Bible, and he alone was to be worshipped. And you see, as things go badly and people are suffering, what they tend to do is they begin to look around, well, who are we going to blame for this? Now, if you go back historically and look at when plagues would break out in Europe, for instance, who did they blame? They blamed the Jews. And so the Jews went through repeated attacks and repeated pogroms to try to wipe them out. And they suffered greatly for their faith. And when I'm sure as we come to the end of the age and things aren't going well, then somebody's going to look for a scapegoat. And to look at Christians or Jews, people are going to do that. Now, when disaster struck towns, cities, or regions in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, it could easily be believed it was the Christians who were at fault. And this sometimes led to mob violence against Christians. And when that got out of hand, sometimes the Roman administrators had to intervene and apply pressure to Christians to get them to recant their beliefs in the Christian God. So look, things are getting out of hand here. We need to settle things down, and you guys need to compromise here in order that people will not be persecuting you and stirring things up. When disaster struck towns, so they would try to get the Christians to change their point of view. So this gives you a little historical background on what was going on. So this is the actual situation of Christians and pagans in the empire. It's not, as the book presents, a case of two warring factions. It was a case of the pagan majority persecuting the Christian minority. Now, if you remember, if you go back to, let's go back to Revelation, because we'll just make note of a scripture here. And you have the church in Ephesus mentioned in Revelation chapter 2. And then you have in Revelation chapter 3 the address to the church in Smyrna. And it says, there are these things, the first and the last, who was dead and came to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. So physically they were poverty stricken, but spiritually they were rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Now, it's speaking of this particular church and speaking of persecution to come. We've looked at it as an individual church and possibly an era. And so what happened? And if you're looking at a day for a year principle, is there a 10-year period where the church was persecuted? And you have to realize they were persecuting Christians. And they looked at all people who said they were followers of Christ as the same, whether they were going in the right direction Christianity-wise or having adopted what we would call a false Christianity. They were all being persecuted. You were all thrown together. So the persecutions against Christians, as it turns out, came to a head right before Constantine appeared on the scene. His predecessor as emperor was a man named Diocletian, who had control of the eastern part of the empire. That's the area that was headquartered in where Constantinople is. And in the west, in Rome, that was controlled by his colleague named Maximian. Now, Diocletian decided that the Christians had to be dealt with once and for all. So in 303 AD, he, with Maximian cooperating, inaugurated an empire-wide persecution. Most of the earlier persecutions going back to the first century were mostly local affairs, not empire-wide. So they issued several imperial edicts that called for the burning of Christian books, the demolition of Christian churches, the removal of class privileges of Christians, and eventually imprisonment for high-ranking Christian clergy. In 304, so this begins in 303, and in 304, a further edict required all Roman subjects to perform sacrifices to the gods. So all you had to do was to come and make a sacrifice to the god, acknowledge him, get a little sheet of paper that indicated you had done that, and you could go on worshiping God. So what do you do as a Christian? It's just a one-time deal. I just have to do this once a year. What do? If you're a true Christian, that puts you in a real tough bind, because if you won't do that, you're defying the government. And so God's people had a tough situation there. What do we do? Do we do this or not? And this was done by edict. The provincial authorities had to make sure that everybody in their community had to do this. So you had a choice of either saying, no, I won't do it, or what other option did you have? You maybe had to say, I've got to go someplace where this isn't going to be an issue. So non-compliance meant death or forced labor. And Christians, of course, could not comply, as we know, without compromising their faith. And this great persecution, as it's called, lasted on and off for nearly a decade. And so you see here that it said that in Revelation chapter 2 that you will have tribulation 10 days. A day for a year would be 10 years. Now, in Lee Teabing's summary, Constantine was the one who brought the conflicts between the pagans and Christians to an end in 325. So does anybody know what significant thing took place, a significant event took place in 325 A.D.? The Council of Nicaea? Council of Nicaea is what took place then. But that's not when this persecution ended. The persecution actually ended in 313 with something called the Edict of Milan. So with these things in mind, let's turn to Constantine's supposed conversion. Now, we know about Constantine's conversion, and that was written by his biographer, whose name was Eusebius. Eusebius wrote a biography of Constantine, which is quite laudatory of Constantine. And Eusebius also wrote a 10-volume history of the church. Now, the historical setting for the conversion is pretty straightforward. After Diocletian voluntarily abdicated in 305 A.D., Constantine became the emperor in his place. So he's the emperor in the east. In Rome itself, however, Maximian laid claim to the imperial throne until Constantine defeated him in battle. But then Maximian's son, Maxentius, took control of the city, and Constantine said, "Hey, look, I still want to be emperor of the whole empire, and I need the chief city to be under my control, so I'm going to have to do battle with you as well." So Constantine marched on Rome, and there was a major battle at a place called the Milvian Bridge, which crosses the Tiber River. And this is when Constantine's supposed conversion took place, before the Battle of Milvian Bridge. Supposedly, he saw a vision, a supernatural sign that occurred to him before battle, a sign that eventually led him to embrace Christianity as the one true religion. Now, according to his account, he knew that he would be victorious in the upcoming battle only if supported by divine power. But he was at a loss concerning which God to petition for aid in his battle. But this vision that he had took place in broad daylight. In the sky, what happened? He saw a standard that was in the shape of a cross. Anything wrong with that picture? Above it were the words, "By this sign, conquer." Now, you have to ask yourself, would God send a Roman emperor a sign of the cross, and in this sign, conquer? Think about the fact that Christ's disciples wanted to fight, didn't they? And he said, "No, my kingdom is not of this world, and we're not going to fight." So here he is going to be supporting the Roman emperor in his conquest of the empire? I don't think so. God's not involved in this fight. Not the true God anyway. So, confused by what this could mean, that night he dreamed that Christ came to him with the same sign and told him to use it as protection against his enemies. Sounds kind of like holding the cross out and we're in a Dracula movie or something. But the next day, Constantine described the sign to artisans he had summoned, and they constructed a lavish version of it from gold and precious stones. It was in the shape of a cross with two Greek letters at the top, Chi and Rho. The first two letters of Christ's name. And according to Eusebius, Constantine called in religious advisors who could explain what it all meant. And they told him that if he would commit himself to worship the Christian God, he would be protected in all things. And under this sign, he then went into battle at Milvian Bridge and was victorious, establishing himself as emperor in the west. And another general became emperor in the east. Now, Lee Teabing in the book is right to intimate that from that moment on, Constantine was not a tried and true Christian with nothing left about him that was pagan. But that's true. He's continued to be, as we'll see, a pagan in actuality. Scholars have noted that he appeared to have continued to worship the sun god even after his conversion. Coins minted in his reign, for example, continue to portray Sol Invictus for 9 years. It appears that Constantine mixed together his older religion and his newfound faith. And that's pretty common. It's called, you know, that people will mix the true religion and false religion and say that that's okay. And God said, no, we want a pure religion. So, it's no accident that he determined the Christian God was to be worshipped on which day? The day of the sun. Why would he choose the day of the sun? Because he worshipped the sun. All right, so that's not hard to understand. And that the birth of Christ came to be celebrated at the time of the winter solstice. Yes, it was a pagan celebration in Rome, but it was the time when the sun began to rise again. It's all tied in with sun worship. But contrary to Teabing's assertion, Constantine certainly began to see himself as a Christian in some sense, starting with this event. But I thought I would share with you how Constantine was, not just the things we've already mentioned, but some other things to consider about him after he was converted. Constantine's actual conversion to Christianity did not occur until he was dying. For only then did he receive the rite of baptism. So if you think about being a Christian, can you be a Christian without repentance and baptism and laying on of hands? You can call yourself that, but you're not. So it is often claimed that it was usual for people of the time to put off such commitments until later years. Constantine's everyday way of life never corresponded to that of Jesus and the apostles. His involvement in the executions of his wife Fausta, his son Crispus, and his sister's stepson, Licinianus, a year after the Council of Nicaea, so he became a Christian supposedly in 312, 313, and he's killing his, in 325, killing his family members? Doesn't sound right, does it? Also, they show us that his value system was anything but that of a follower of Christ. Certainly aspects of Christian belief influenced his rule, but his career demonstrates more evidence of continued pagan adherence than personal commitment to Christ. A writer by the name of Norwich notes that by the end of his life, the emperor was probably succumbing to religious megalomania. From being God's chosen instrument, it was but a short step to being God himself. That sumus deus in whom all other gods and other religions were subservient to. Perhaps that is why Constantine's lifelong balancing act between paganism and Roman Christianity continued in the recognition others afforded him posthumously. The Roman Senate said he was a god at his death. According to the historian Michael Grant, it was a curious indication that his adoption of the Christian faith did not prevent this pagan custom from being retained. Nevertheless, his service to his preferred version of Christianity caused the Orthodox Church to name him a saint. He is Saint Constantine. As for Constantine himself, he made sure that he would be remembered in a very specific way. For several years, he had taken to referring himself as equal of the apostles. That's a pretty heady statement to make. He called himself the equal of the apostles. Thus he planned to be buried in a church erected in Constantinople during his reign, the Church of the Holy Apostles. There, upon his death in 337, the emperor was placed in a sarcophagus and flanked on either side by 6 standing sarcophagi said to contain relics from the 12 apostles. He was the 13th apostle, or better yet, cast in the role of Christ himself in the center of his original apostles. He was Constantine the Great, an emperor whose pretensions at being a god suppressed his masters commanded humility even in death. So he was an interesting fellow. So some things he's accused of, he actually did. Some things that he's accused of, he didn't do. Now, as you think about the question is, why did Constantine, remember it said that Constantine chose to become a Christian because he was backing the winning team, the winning side. And it's hard to know why he chose to back Christians, since they weren't the largest group in the nation or in the empire. It's clear that Constantine was intent on unifying the empire that had been fractured for so long. During the 50 years before the accession of Diocletian, the empire had seen 20 different emperors. So it was a chaotic time. And he took a series of financial and political steps to unify the empire. And possibly by aligning himself with the Christian God, he saw a way of bringing cultural unity to the empire. And people could see, okay, if I do this, it's going to bring unity, and that's what I want with the empire. I don't want all the wars going on, so how do I bring unity? So I'm willing to do whatever I have to do. So if I back this group and it will bring unity to the empire, then that's what I'll do. But that's not conversion. That's just using what you think to be a religion in your favor to bring about what you want. So it would bring about one empire that worshiped the one God, and with one emperor at its helm. And what's beyond dispute is that Constantine's conversion was one of the most significant events in the history of Western civilization. Christianity, or what is called Christianity, went from being a persecuted and much hated minority religion within the empire to being the religious preference of the emperor himself. Favors were showered on the church, and it became exceedingly popular to become a Christian and thereby renounce pagan gods. Conversions happened in droves, and by the end of the 4th century, Christians were the majority of the empire's population. All of the emperors after Constantine, except one, were Christian. And within 50 years of his death, Christianity was the official religion of the empire. So he did have quite an influence on Roman Christianity coming to power. But his conversion and the Edict of Toleration of 313 weren't the end of the story. Because what you find in Christianity is all this feuding and disputing. This religion is supposed to bring unity to the empire. They're all feuding and disputing. So that brings us to the reason for the Council of Nicaea. Christianity wasn't unified over several fundamental issues, none more important than its theological views. In order for Christianity to unify the empire, it had to first unify itself. And that's the real reason that Constantine called a council of Christian bishops, 200 to 250. And they were called to resolve problems that had been causing internal squabbles among Christians. So they met in a city called Nicaea. So it's called the Council of Nicaea. Now, does anybody remember what kind of decisions they made at the Council of Nicaea? Several significant ones. They made a decision that the death of Christ would be celebrated, or the resurrection of Christ, I guess, would be celebrated on Easter. All right? Now, why did they have to make that decision? It tells you that not everybody was celebrating it on Easter, that there were people still doing it on the 14th of Nisan. And that had to be stopped. You want unity. Any other things you might remember that they stopped? I think you had to stop Judaizing Sabbath. So, hey, we've got these people over here causing trouble meeting on Saturday. No, the day of worship is the venerable day of the sun. And so you have these people, all the emperors involved here, and you have the power of the Roman Empire thrown behind Roman Catholicism. And it became the dominant force. Now, One of the things that is brought out in the book about this Council of Nicaea is the following. So there's this discussion going on, and so I'm quoting from the book. It says, during this fusion of religions, Constantine needed to strengthen the new Christian tradition and held a famous ecumenical gathering known as the Council of Nicaea. At this gathering, Teabing said, many aspects of Christianity were debated and voted upon. The date of Easter, the role of bishops, the administration of the sacraments, and of course, the divinity of Jesus. Now, I don't follow his divinity. My dear, Teabing declared, until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nonetheless, a mortal. Not the Son of God, right, Teabing said. Jesus' establishment as the Son of God was officially proposed and voted on by the Council of Nicaea. Hold on, you're saying Jesus' divinity was the result of a vote? A relatively close vote at that, Teabing added. By officially endorsing Jesus as the Son of God, Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world, an entity whose power was unchangeable. Did that take place at the Council of Nicaea? That he was designated as divine? Well, that wasn't the issue. Was Christ divine? Nobody had a question about that. The question was how he was divine. So do you know how what decision they made about his divinity? See, they couldn't understand how he could be Jesus and God the Father and be one God. So out of that council came the concept of the Trinity. That was the solution to the problem, which we know to be not the solution to the problem. It's really not a problem if you understand that God's a family and there's God the Father and Jesus Christ. That's pretty simple, isn't it? But you had Greek thinking and carnal thinking, and they couldn't see that. And so they came up with this three-in-one idea. But that's the issue they were voting on there. There was no question about his being divine. For instance, as you look at the scriptures, Jesus was seen as divine from the beginning. There was no question about him being divine and him being a man. As you look at the scriptures, you go, and these scriptures were, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They tell you who he was. How did Jesus come into being? Tells you all that. You go to John chapter 1. You know, if somebody ever asks you about it, let's begin in Mark chapter 1. Look at verse 1. Mark 1, verse 1. It says here, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It begins right off the bat telling you who he is, that he is the Son of God. And it goes on to describe, where did he come from? Who was he originally? And, you know, as you go, the scriptures call him repeatedly the Son of God, and also call him the Son of Man, because he was a flesh and blood human being, and he was also the Son of God, begotten by the Holy Spirit. But let's go to John chapter 1. Where did he come from? John clearly tells you. He says in John chapter 1, verse 1, the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So Jesus Christ, the one who became Jesus Christ, is here known as the Word, and he was with God. Verse 2 says, he was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. He was a God being, with God from the very beginning. And then you go down to verse 14, and it tells us, then the Word, this God being, became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. He was a flesh and blood human being who had at one time been God. As Philippians tells us, he was equal with God. in that he was a spirit being. And he emptied himself of being a spirit being, and through the Spirit, she was impregnated and became the mother of Jesus Christ, the one we know as Christ. Now, so you see this, that he had to be divine, he had to be originate from God, and he had to be mortal as well. So from the very beginning, as far back as we have Christian writings, it became commonplace to understand that Jesus was in some sense divine. We would not have any problem with that. In fact, as you kind of hear some of the things that are said in the book, you're kind of like, what? And we haven't touched the interesting stuff yet, or the really controversial stuff. We're just talking about Constantine and some of the ideas about him. So what you have to realize is this is a novel. So novelists tend to distort the facts. Like when you see a movie about a certain subject, it says based on a true story. And sometimes if you know the true story, it's like, boy, that is a very loose basing on that true story. But they've got to embellish it and make it dramatic. You know, that's how it is. And he has to do the same thing. But the problem is people can read this and they don't know the answers to it. And people can come to you and say, well, what do you think of the Da Vinci Code? Because it is widely read. And you can say, not much. But you can also have an answer as to why you think, I don't think much of it. So, we know Jesus was a fully man and fully God. So that gives us a place to stop at here. We're looking at Constantine a little bit and some of those kinds of things. So next time we'll talk about a few other things involved with this in the meantime, you'll have an answer at least for a few things about the Da Vinci Code. So have a good remainder of the afternoon. Enjoy the time of rest and rejuvenation God's given us.